Some time ago, a group of 38 people watched and listened to a real-life murder without offering any aid. I'll be back in a moment with the amazing facts about the Golden Rule in reverse. Hello, this is Joe Cruz and the Amazing Facts broadcast, facts which affect you. One dark night, a young woman in the respectable suburb of Kew Gardens, New York, was stabbed to death by a man in the street. It took him half an hour to accomplish his purpose. His victim broke away from him twice and tried to crawl to safety, screaming repeatedly for help. 38 people in nearby apartments heard her cries, came to the window to look out, and did absolutely nothing more. When somebody finally called the police, they arrived in just 2 minutes flat. But the woman was dead and her murderer was gone. In Albany, New York, a mentally retarded youth teetered on the roof of a downtown hotel. A group of 3,000 people gathered below. There were shouts of "jump, jump," and taunts of "you're chicken." A little girl capered about on the sidewalk, imitating the frantic gestures of the would-be suicide. When the policeman finally coaxed him off the dizzy ledge, boos rang out from the crowd below, believe it or not. Now you might say, how can things like that ever happen in American cities? Are we becoming a nation of cowards? What's happened to people that they'll not move a muscle to help a fellow human being in mortal danger? Now these episodes, friends, have stirred a ripple of national conscience. Psychiatrists and others have tried to explain the actions of the public in such cases. Some allege that incidents of this kind are the product of urban living, a sign of the inevitable brutalization that comes with existence in the great crowded cities. And yet, Albany is hardly a metropolis. And can any American assert with assurance that such things could not happen in his own hometown and maybe on his own quiet street where he lives? Other observers hold that fear paralyzes the natural impulse to help a fellow mortal in distress. The outsider is afraid of endangering his own safety by trying to thwart a criminal act, it's argued. Yet the Kew Gardens apartment dwellers did not have to go down into the street and struggle with the stabber. All they needed to do was just pick up the telephone at their bedside and call the police. Yet nobody in that nightmare half hour was willing to do even that much. The witnesses to that crime, when questioned later about their lack of action, had only the feeblest of excuses. One man said, "Well, I was tired." Another said she was afraid her husband would get involved. Several, when asked why they didn't ask for help on the telephone, simply replied, "I don't know." Another explanation that's been offered is that Americans have grown so inured to scenes of crime and violence on television that the actual thing has no reality for them. It seems only a spectacle rather than some tragic happening. But if the American public is that far out of touch with reality, friends, we are a long way down the road toward becoming a dead nation. The cruelty of the ancient Romans who cheered while Christians were devoured by lions is a scar, of course, on the face of human history. The Romans, however, were at least reacting with some kind of emotion, no matter how inappropriate, to that bloody spectacle that they saw in the arena. We've come to a time when people are not even reacting at all. The attitude of many Americans toward the danger and suffering of others seems almost worse. Its characteristic feature is a kind of hard-eyed apathy. People who watch others in mortal jeopardy often don't seem to care at all. And this attitude indicates a deep sickness of selfishness. People shun getting involved in other people's troubles. They're looking out for number one. Everybody knows that such callousness is not universal, of course. But it's hard to deny that it's on the increase in big cities and small, in crowded slums and on farms. Wherever you look, you'll find it there. The episodes reported could be the handwriting on the wall, a fateful warning to American society. I tell you, a nation cannot survive whose people expect to live in the surroundings of a high civilization and yet follow the rule of the jungle in their human relationships. And it's no good pretending that this is a problem only for the teeming millions of New Yorkers. Men have always been self-centered. In the slums, the high-rise apartments, wherever you go, no individual can know for sure how he would behave if confronted by a desperate challenge to rescue another human being. I'm sure all of us hope that we'd step out there and even risk our lives to save another, and yet how can we be sure? We've got to be able to break through that shell that holds people apart. Perhaps the only way to make that exercise easier is to practice it. Practice it in small daily acts of conscious consideration for other people. The story of the Good Samaritan is central in the teachings of Jesus. It is also, however, the necessary rule of civilization. People cannot survive in our world who will not help each other, and who will not identify with each other's dangers and troubles. The mental hospitals are filled with men and women who feel shut off from contact from other human beings. Yes, the bell that tolled for a murdered girl in Kew Gardens does indeed toll for all of us. And if we can't help each other in a moment of desperate need, we are ourselves beyond help. If we must pursue personal security above all other goals, we're doomed. Although overshadowed by the H-bomb, communist infiltration and subversion, the greatest threat to American security may yet prove to be the moral decay within. What could be termed a moral decline only a year or two ago has become a plummeting moral descent today. And this apparent disintegration of personal morals is not reflected in the crime figures alone. It's evident in the type of literature, motion pictures, other entertainment that the public permits to be distributed and displayed with only an occasional weak protest. It manifests itself also in the soaring divorce rate among adults and in the undocumented but nevertheless discernible rise of sexual promiscuity among teenagers. Any number of factors have contributed to this moral phenomenon which has gone so rapidly from shocking to downright frightening. The spread of a materialistic philosophy which denies or belittles the spiritual aspect of man's nature. A psychology which holds that man's physical drives must be gratified with all expediency if he's to be well-adjusted and happy. The only solution is to return to the moral laws of God, which hold that right and wrong are not relative values at all, but are definite and unchanging principles. From time to time, all down the ages, strong, ambitious men have tried to bring in an era of peace and prosperity from which all poverty and discontent could be banished. 2,500 years ago, Nebuchadnezzar looked on the capital city of his empire, and he said, "Is not this great Babylon that I've built?" Daniel 4:30. Now, this man had reason to be proud, friends. So prosperous was Babylon that people called it the Golden City in Isaiah 14:4. It was so strong and so well fortified that it was considered to be impregnable to any enemy. Nebuchadnezzar was sure that something so rich, so beautiful, so powerful would have to last forever. But it didn't last forever, friends. Behind the massive fortifications, the treasures bursting with gold and silver, the elaborate hanging gardens and public works, there lurked crime, cruelty, extortion, injustice, 100 other vices. So much so that at the first real test, the whole fabric collapsed and Darius the Median took the kingdom, according to Daniel 5 and verse 31. You see, friends, things may look good on the outside. Our own civilization today seems very prosperous and wonderful. And yet behind it all, we find those same moral perversions taking place that were also transpiring in the great city of Babylon. Babylon possessed all the outward marks of permanence. Boundless riches, powerful army, and seemingly impregnable defense system. But it lacked respect for God. And these qualities of character, my friends, must be present. Most Babylonians cared not for things like that. Consequently, their dreams of a peaceful future faded into history. And this will be the inevitable fate of all efforts to build a utopian society without God. God will have to be in the middle of it, and a recognition of true quality character will also be necessary for any men or nations to build a truly successful society. Today, of course, a mighty effort is being made to build a society greater than anything in the past. And protected by a seemingly impregnable atomic defense system, its sponsors, no doubt with the very best of motives, are pouring astronomical sums of money and the hope of ushering in a period of universal prosperity unparalleled since time began. Billions upon billions are being provided for the aged, the needy, the uneducated. Not since Robin Hood has there been such an elaborate scheme to soak the rich and feed the poor. Never has so much money been scattered in so many directions simultaneously and with such utter recklessness. And if an ideal society could be built with money, then the dream of the centuries would now be close to realization. But alas, friends, it cannot be. Money may be helpful, but it's not the first or essential requirement. Many solutions have been explored, material and philosophical, all with equally unsatisfactory results. The optimism of recent decades is waning in these final years of the 20th century. Man's mightiest efforts to improve the lot of humanity are ending in undeniable failure, as we see from endlessly rising crime rates, corruption in government, the AIDS epidemic, widespread famines, burgeoning immorality and vice practiced among the youngest to the oldest members of our society. And added to all this are the stresses of rising tension between nations, wars, and a global economic crisis that could momentarily bring all nations into crashing ruin. Ah, much good is being done, friends. We can't deny that, but it does not keep pace with the problems that need to be solved. It's not pessimistic, but realistic to acknowledge that the problems we face are beyond human solution. However, there's an answer far above humanism and politics, far beyond escapism and fantasy. It's Christ's soon coming kingdom that will usher in a new order of justice, peace, and righteousness. After his crucifixion and resurrection, Jesus ascended to heaven to prepare that kingdom and perform the work involved in making up his subjects. It would be well to consider how God is preparing a perfect home for all those who trust in him. Except a man be born again, Jesus said, he cannot see the kingdom of God, John 3:3. Now that's where God begins, friends. At birth, a spiritual rebirth, a conversion, a totally new way of thinking. That's why God's new world of tomorrow will be unlike any that men are trying to build today, and it will last forever. It will be built on the solid foundation of God-fearing people, on the character of people transformed by His love and power, on men and women who love righteousness and truth, and know what it means to walk with God. Long ago, King David wrote, "Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it," Psalms 127, 1. And how true those words are today. Let me ask you something, friends. Would you like to be a part of God's holy nation of peace, founded on the golden rule of doing unto others as you would like to have them do to you? I'm sure that you would. And now, this is Joe Cruz saying goodbye for today.